I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I am talking to Inez Valdez, Associate Professor of Political Science at Ohio State University. We're discussing her 2019 book, Transnational Cosmopolitanism, Kant, Du Bois, and Justice as a Political Craft. Valdez works on cosmopolitanism, sovereignty, and immigration, and the relationship to race, gender, and religious identity. She has published several articles on these topics, including two in the American Political Science Review. So first of all, let me say, Inez Valdez, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. I appreciate being here. Thank you for the invitation.
So Inez, the book's very impressive. I very much enjoyed it. It's a sweeping discussion of really kind of two different traditions of cosmopolitanism. It's how I thought of it anyway. The first is a tradition that derives from Kant and taken up by contemporary neo-Kantians. And you point out some distinct limitations with that really dominant approach in political theory. And then a second approach, which is really your positive contribution in the book, what you call transnational cosmopolitanism, which you root in the thought of W.E.B. Du Bois. So I appreciated both approaches, both the critical and the constructive approach. So thank you for the book. Let me ask by first start by asking, what was the motivation for writing the book?
Right. So I think that the way in which you phrase the question is actually useful to get into what the motivation was, because it was partly frustration at seeing these two traditions not speak to each other. And this is for several reasons. So first, there was, first was the narrow focus of the contemporary literature on cosmopolitanism. And by narrow focus, I mean mainly that it is focused on canonical thinkers, and not only canonical thinkers, but in particular, Immanuel Kant, that, you know, as I've been writing in the last, I guess already, not 10 years yet, but what about 7 to 8 years, you know, I started as a Kantian scholar that was looking for answers in Kant, and, you know, slowly but surely, I started finding that there were more limitations than I felt comfortable with, and started looking elsewhere. Now, you could, of course, say that most of the Anglo-American tradition in political theory has the same kind of lack of dynamic engagement with non-Western traditions. But you would think that the literature on cosmopolitanism has a special, in a way, incentive, or at least a special obligation to get, you know, normative, to look into other traditions to the extent that they are offering a global project, right? They are offering an account of global justice. And so that was the first kind of source of frustration, and a narrow focus on canonical Western thinkers, in particular Kant, for a project that is supposed to be global. I think a second frustration was how this Kantian scholarship was really limited to considering politics by thinking about the domestic and the international realm. So while they were avowedly cosmopolitan, they still were considering how to, in a way, conceptualize cosmopolitanism without really exiting narratives of, or not narratives, but frameworks of popular sovereignty and international organizations and international federation. And so that was the second source of frustration with the literature. And I think that then the third motivation for the book is the one I started with, the fact that there was out there another tradition for the taking, in a way, that had been engaged relatively extensively, though recently, by the humanities, which was the work of W.E.B. Du Bois on empire and internationalism. And I say that it has been mostly the humanities, although this has to some extent changed. I mean, there's more engagement with his international work since I started writing the book. But of course, I mean, Du Bois is in a way a canonical thinker in American political thought, but he is a canonical thinker for his writings on race and American democracy, rather than for his writings on the global or on empire. So Du Bois is not considered a global thinker, and I wanted to bring him into this conversation as a global thinker that could helped me really work through some of these limitations that I mentioned in the Kantian or neo-Kantian literature and open paths forward to think about cosmopolitanism differently.
Good. So I thought we could start with the critical side of the book, in which you discuss first Kant and then the neo-Kantians. So maybe we could start with Kant. You discuss, your chapter on Kant discusses a focus on perpetual peace, which is Kant's very famous 1795 piece. Mm-hmm. If you first see the distinction in Kant between international right and cosmopolitan right. This is a kind of conceptual mm-hmm. distinction Kant makes, which is has been quite influential. And one of your focuses on Kant's relationship to colonialism mm-hmm. with regard to this. And one of the ways that scholars have read Kant is as a kind of critic of colonialism, which is somewhat surprising. Usually we see a lot of Enlightenment thinkers championing colonialism. Kant, however, is mm-hmm. is a critic of colonialism, but you're skeptical of this reading of Kant as a kind of critic of colonialism, and given a very interesting contextual reading of Kant, what's going on in Kant's time, and what Kant's real motivation here is in perpetual peace. Maybe you could say a little bit more about that context for perpetual peace and how it sort of limits the applicability of Kant, do you think, for contemporary concerns?
Right. So, yes, thank you for that question. And I think the way in which this chapter is structured is that on the one hand, it does address the existing literature on Kant's cosmopolitanism and his critique of colonialism, and also sets the stage for, first the methodological and interpretational strategy in the book, as well as the later critique. So I'll try to kind of address both of those things, starting with the scholarship and the context. So yes, I mean, definitely Kant has been read as a critic of colonialism, and unlike many other Enlightenment thinkers in, you know, what has become known as the political theory of empire, or liberalism and empire literature. This is how I started reading him, because there is no denying that there's a very strong language that highlights the cruelty of the practices of Europeans in the colonies, the kind of the way in which colonial conflict really derails intra-European relations, and even in later work, not in Perpetual Peace but in Doctrine of Right, specific critiques of settlement, of arguments that were being used to justify European settlement, which, you know, Kant quite strongly pushes against. And so, I mean, I don't contend that there is a critique of colonialism there. Although what I contest is what that critique of colonialism is doing in his overall project. And one way in which I think it may be helpful to express this is that rather than a full-on critique of colonialism, most of the critical engagement with colonialism is a critique of colonial conflict. And I'll explain what I mean by that. One can take issue with the structure of authority and the structure of government and the forms of oppression entailed by colonialism. But if you read closely Perpetual Peace, what you see is that most of the focus is on the conflict, is on the forms of conquest, the forms of exploitation. And in particular, what I think is quite interesting, and it's somewhat hidden in the text, is that he is quite concerned with the way in which European countries are increasing the amount, the duration, and the kind of, I don't know how we call it, the amount and duration of conflict among themselves by getting engaged in conflict over the colonies. And so I say that it's somewhat hidden because if you read the text, most of the third article of Perpetual Peace, which is the article that defines cosmopolitanism, is actually devoted to an anti-colonial critique. or an anti-colonial or a critique of colonial conflict, as I would rather put it. And so I say that these clues are somewhat hidden in the text, because if you look at the third article, which is the article that develops the realm of cosmopolitanism, most of the text is devoted to criticize colonial conflict, but he's also quite specifically focusing on six colonial regions. And so these regions had not been analyzed in and of themselves for the role that they played. They had just been taken to be examples of colonialism that Kant was criticizing. But if you look at what was happening in 1794, 1795 in these places, what you see is that these were all places of intra-European conflict and rivalry. And so he mentions the Cape of Good Hope, which is current-day Cape Town in South Africa, the West Indies, which he also calls Sugar Islands in the Caribbean, the East Indies, or current-day Indians of Asia, America, which by context you kind of figure out that it's North America. He also mentions the Spice Islands, which are islands off the coast of current-day Indonesia. And finally, he mentions West Africa. He calls this quote-unquote Negro countries, and he's actually talking about slavery trading posts, and that's why we know it's West Africa. And so each and every one of these places was the subject of colonial rivalry at the time Kant was writing, or a few years early. And in particular, these were points of contention around two wars, two important European wars, the American Revolutionary Wars between the colonies and Britain, that also, of course, pitted Britain against the Dutch and the French, but also later the Revolutionary Wars, the wars of the Allied Western powers against France, newly Republican France. And so once you find the very, you know, deep significance and symbolism of these particular places that he chooses to focus on, and he in fact focuses, I mean, most of the discussion is on this on these places, then I think that it makes sense to think about this critique as a critique of the conflict. And here's the second interpretative step that I make based on this finding, and that is that if this is a focus on conflict, then perhaps this article shouldn't be read as Kant's, well, I mean, it should be read as Kant's article on cosmopolitanism, but it should be read alongside the articles on international, on the international realm and the domestic realm, because the form of conflict that Kant is describing happens to be detrimental to the goals that he has for European countries to come together in an international federation, because colonialism simply expands the space, the territory on which Europeans can engage in conflict, or the reasons for Europeans to engage in conflict. It also raises the risk of expansion, and what he would call is excessive expansion, in particular in the case of Britain. At the time he was writing, he was quite concerned with the power of the Navy and the way in which the trading companies served as unconventional armies. So this kind of conflation between trade and war. And he's also, of course, just by focusing on these points of conflict, which I argue have to do with conflict happening during the Revolutionary Wars, it also ties to his concern with, or his expectation that republics will progress and develop. And so this conflict was also taking resources away from new republics like France and the United States that could otherwise have been used for more edifying purposes. And so once you read this article, the third article on cosmopolitanism as a critique of colonial conflict, and then you connect this conflict to very clear priorities on his writings on international politics and his writings on domestic politics and republicanism, I think that it is not so clear that what Kant was trying to do here is mount a moral critique of colonialism, but rather tie together what was happening in the colonies with the trends that he was observing in these other two realms and express his preoccupation. Now, that said, I do think that there is a moral condemnation of colonialism in Kant. This appears in the particular language that he uses to describe the cruelty of conflict and other forms of condemnation, but also appears very clearly when he condemns settlement in the Doctrine of Right. And here is where kind of we move to kind of the other limitation that I see in Kant, and that is, well, yes, I mean, there might be a normative critique of colonialism there, but that doesn't seem to be his main goal. And even when he does this, when he does condemn settlement in the Doctrine of Right, this is again, this doesn't seem the main concern of Kant in these writings. And then the question is, well, why would we take this, you know, not footnotes, but, you know, very limited engagements with specifically the morality of colonialism and go with it to address questions today when it seems that first, his main goal was something else. And as a consequence, second, he does not provide, you know, a full-fledged kind of critique of colonialism in and of itself. And to that, I would add, he also is not concerned with the way in which oppression is experienced by colonial subjects. And as a consequence, he doesn't give us, as a theorist, an ability to think about emancipation, oppression on the one hand, from the experience, seen from the experience or from the perspective of those oppressed, but also the way in which they can think of and act toward emancipation. And this is despite the fact that the Haitian Revolution was, of course, taking place as he was writing. So I think those are that's kind of my two-step argument. So first, I think predominantly he's criticizing conflict for reasons that have to do with his kind of notion of progress, a teleological notion of progress, and having to do with how conflict affects his goals for Europe in terms of an international federation and the growth and expansion of republics. And second, that even if there is a bit of a critique of colonialism, then it's perhaps not, you know, the most resourceful source or the most resourceful thinker for such a critique. And then why, you know, really going back to him. And just a footnote in terms of the question of hierarchy, because I do say that there is a moral critique of colonialism, but I also say in the book that I don't think that this critique is necessarily inconsistent with remaining hierarchical notions of civilization and race. And this has to do with the way in which two things. It has to do with the way in which these writings are the focus of this critique on colonialism vis-a-vis his earlier writings on colonialism and race. And second, of course, I mean, the lack of evidence that that he, you know, really changes his mind regarding race and colonialism. And so regarding the first point, if you read his essays on or his lectures on anthropology and geography, which is where most of his writings on civilization and race that are explicitly hierarchical and racist and, you know, biological in their framing and forms of explanation, he's not really addressing the same questions that he addresses in his critique of colonialism in Perpetual Peace. He's addressing the capacity of the subjects to self-govern, their ability or willingness to work versus, you know, remain, you know, be like, you know, laziness and whatnot. And so that is very clearly assessments about, you know, how race, but also race activated by climate results in particular propensities and dispositions, and how these dispositions are not the right ones and are the ones that Europeans possess that will lead to the development of skill and culture and civilization. But when we go to his writings on colonialism in the 1790s, he doesn't return to these problems. He's just dealing with a different problem. So he does condemn the morality of conquest and settlement. But he does not address in any specific way the questions that motivated his earlier writings. And so ultimately, it's we can only speculate about what he was thinking. But in principle, and also in terms of the way in which, also based on the way in which he thought about notions of unity as unity of, within diversity, it is perfectly consistent with his thinking to condemn particular practices against colonial subjects without considering these subjects fully equal. In fact, I mean, this was his position regarding women in the sense that he was... condemn morally violence against women, but that doesn't mean that he considered women to be equal to men. So again, I mean, in the absence of explicit, you know, writings stating that this is what I said 20 years ago, I guess 15 years ago, and this is what I believe now, we can only speculate. But I think that the evidence, at least, says that he was not talking about the same kind of colonialism that he had developed and kind of at least partially imposed, I mean, partially praising it earlier. These are not the same issues that he takes up in the 1790s. So,
yeah, let me follow up on a few of these things because I mean, that very last point that you made, which is has been taken up in recent scholarship. I mean, namely that Kant seems in his earlier work to so justify colonialism in a you know, kind of stereotypically Enlightenment way, which is that there are certain peoples that are sort of constitutionally unequal to European societies, and so it's justified on European side to help them. They're like children, in other words, right? And so it's justified then for adults to help children towards enlightenment. But right, so but then in the, I guess the account goes in the 1790s, though, so some of that anthropological stuff disappears, but Kant does then give some strong support to say you say strengthen the sovereignty of traditionally colonialized peoples, right? So he has that, I guess it's in the Metaphysics of Morals, not in the Perpetual Peace, but that section in which Kant talks about, well, Europeans have claimed these rights to these wide open spaces, and they say, well, there's nobody living here or working on the land, so we deserve it. Kant says, no, I mean, this belongs to the these peoples, and they have a right to a kind of self-determination there. So at least Kant is moving the direction of an attempt to undermine the kinds of claims that he seemed to argue for in the in his earlier career. I guess you're right that he doesn't have an explicit, you know, statement, I was wrong earlier, but I just wonder why the inference isn't in the direction of so maybe he's reconsidering things.
So you're absolutely right. I mean, he does strengthen the sovereignty of non-European regions. I mean, that's already present in Perpetual Peace, but it's more systematically done in the Metaphysics of Moral. But, I mean, again, I mean, in principle, there is no inconsistency between... So, or put it in a different way, there is no need to recognize the equality of these peoples to recognize their right to self-determination. And let me try to explain it in this way. There are in Kant several ways in which, take the example of the French Revolution, right? I mean, he condemned the revolution morally. There is wide agreement about that. But there is also a recognition that there is an engagement with the revolutionary project or with the Republican project at least that is quite positive. And so, you know, people have made sense of this through, you know, his discussion of spectatorship and other. But there is this kind of inconsistency also in his approach to revolution. And so I do think that... he may be judging that the means of conquest and the establishment of colonies and settlements are performed with such cruelty, are in fact so barbaric and this is the term that he uses to describe Europeans in Perpetual Peace, at least, and perhaps also in the Metaphysics of Morals, that this is not something that he can kind of stand behind.
Hmm.
And so that doesn't mean that he right. thinks that these peoples, kind of, you know, without the tutelage of Europeans, will become as civilized as Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
That's that. And in fact, this is also an argument of, about civilization, and this I didn't mention earlier, but there is also a worry in Kant that the cruelty that he witnesses in these very unconventional wars in the colonies that, you know, I don't know with what grounds, but he seems to argue that they are much crueler and less kind of, you know, honorific than other kinds of war, like wars between Europeans. And so there is something about even the dangers to European civilization of engaging in such cruel practices, European civilization, or even the character of the soldiers that engage in these practices. And so I think I would separate those two things mm-hmm. and say, yeah, we have a lot of claims about the practices of conquest and the cruelty against slaves and the depredations and et cetera. And that we have, and I acknowledge that, but that still doesn't tell us that left to their own devices, Kant believed that these peoples would, you know, be equally civilized.
Yeah, I wonder if it's useful to sort of distinguish the two levels of Kant's project, as it were. I mean, you have the sort of the a priori noumenal side where human beings, all human beings, sort of universally, mm-hmm. Kant argues, have certain rights. Men, women, all different races. And so that, you might say, is this sort of universal or cosmopolitan moment. But then there's also this empirical, embodied, a posteriori side to Kant, in which he's very attentive to the different physical constitutions and racial compositions, gender compositions of peoples. And there, Kant talks about all sorts of inequality. And in fact, so that bleeds over. I mean, the example about women is useful because that bleeds over into politics, in the sense that for Kant, the sort of former form of equality supports a broad swath of liberal rights. But the latter form of inequality points towards an inequality in, you could say, political participation, that women don't have voting rights in the way that men do. And so maybe, I mean, that maybe that's the sort of side. So you can imagine that in the international realm, that Kant might license, say, the Federation of Nations, that the, you know, formerly colonized people shouldn't have as great of participation rights because they're, you know, not further advanced into civilization as Europeans.
Right. I don't get into that in my book at all, but I mean, in general, to the extent that I try to engage with the universal, because it's a book about cosmopolitanism after all.
Yeah.
what I tend to think is that, I mean, yeah, this might be separable kind of projects, and there's of course a big debate among Kantians on whether these are separable or they are, you know, ultimately always connected. So this might be separable projects, but this kind of a priori nominal project, what I will argue in the second half of the book is that, well, I mean, we need to do more than just establish this principle
right.
and hope for the best. And this kind of more that we have to do is express this supposed equal concern that
right.
kind of emerges from these universal principles in a way that is, we have to perform in a way this equal concern, not just declare it, right?
Yeah.
And so, and the performance then needs to translate into an engagement with those subjects who are marginalized and those peoples that are oppressed, and try to reconstruct the character of injustice based on what I call political craft, as part of the title of the book.
Yeah.
I think in principle you can separate those, but then I would also say, well, but that universalism, still, we need to do more work.
Yeah, I mean, in part, I wonder if well, this is a question I had for you for later, but I mean, it's relevant now, which is, I mean, in part, I wonder, you know, what your argument is that Kant's view of justice is just too limited in the sense that his sort of liberal view of rights doesn't take account of the, say, need for recognition or equal recognition among people. Mm-hmm. You know, Kant is just not attuned to that sort of thing in the way that Hegel, you know, starts to develop a notion of recognition and in his master-slave mm-hmm. dialectic that I take it Du Bois was influenced by. And so in other words, I mean, I wonder how much part of the problem with Kant is it's just too limited of a vision of justice.
Right. I think my short answer would be yes. I mean, I do find his view of justice, in particular, the exclusion from this view questions of recognition and this, and dialectics that are part of this processes, important. I mean, and in fact, kind of central to define what justice is about. But what I would also say, I think that what I try to do after, you know, this very engaged kind of contextual analysis of perpetual peace, what I try to do is, first move to neo-Kantism, but then say, but how about if we read, if we take from Kant what really speaks to us in the present moment, right? So part of what I'm trying to do in the book is saying, we don't have to, you know, embrace whole thinkers and, you know, reject them completely. I think the underlying kind of methodological project is to say, when we do historical political thought, or rather than we do historical political thought, when we aim to bring canonical thinkers into conversations about the present and about questions of justice and injustice, there is a need to be aware of the hierarchies that are embedded in those frameworks. But once we're aware of those, we can have a more creative engagement with these thinkers and take from them what can be useful. And in fact, I do consider his notion of hospitality and his notion of interconnection of realms potentially productive. And, you know, I rescue that and I see I show ways in which we could read Kant otherwise, so to speak. Partly because the project is, we don't need to, you know, just do everything with just one thinker. And as long as what we're doing is explicitly, anachronistic in the sense of it ceases to be anachronistic once I'm aware of the hierarchies and I'm kind of separating them from the particular pieces and I'm making a case for why these particular pieces are useful, right? But overall, I think I find it more productive, at least, to use thinkers in this way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and so let's talk about those neo-Kantians or the contemporary liberal theorists who appropriate Kant, which are many of them. You mentioned Sheila Benabib, James Bowman, Thomas Poga, lots of folks who are, sorry?
That would be...
Yes, lots of folks who are quite influenced by Kant here and theorizing the cosmopolitan domain. And so maybe instead of running through some of them, which you do a nice job and sort of Habermas, of course, how could we forget? Instead of running through each individually, I thought we could pick out some of your main criticisms. That first of all, one of the claims that you make against the neo-Kantians is there's three different forms of Eurocentrism that you argue are still sort of present in their thought. The first one is what you call federative Eurocentrism, which is that thinkers remain focused on the project of building a kind of federated association out of nation states, often European nation states. And so, for instance, Habermas has this fundamental concern with building the EU and sort of building international associations and a cosmopolitan order out of the building blocks of European states. And so it's Eurocentric in the sense that it's the building blocks there are with the European states, and its fundamental concern is quelling their conflicts rather than addressing the inequalities that are sort of built in or constitutive in that project. So maybe you could say a little bit more about that and where you see it in some of these thinkers.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you said, I mean, the first kind of Eurocentrism that I define is federative Eurocentrism. And I openly recognize that there is, they have shared, all the explicitly hierarchical dimensions of Kant. But what I'm trying to look at is at how Kantian features of thought or Kantian structures or institutional structures by which we're supposed to kind of, approach justice remain in a way limiting of the things that neo-Kantian scholars can see and cannot see. And so when it comes to federative Eurocentrism, I think that there are two ways in which this kind of focus can be Eurocentric. And so the first one kind of has us returning to Kant in the sense that equality was a very important principle for Kant's system to work. And so one of the reasons why colonialism was so problematic for his project of European peace was that it could lead to the disproportionate expansion of one European power. And with the disproportionate expansion of one European power, what he thought was this asocial sociability, which was this friction that eventually leads to conflict, and conflict that eventually leads to conflict fatigue and reconsideration of the terms of engagement, and eventually it leads to a federation. This could only happen if the powers were never disproportionately different, if one wasn't disproportionately more powerful than the others. And so one way in which a federation seems ill-fitted to think about the world today is that it assumes that this is a grouping of relatively equal states. And so we just don't have such a situation when you think about the world as a whole. And so that is one problem of the federative structure.
Right. So just that, I mean, the UN and the European Union are putatively international cosmopolitan organizations with member states that are equal, but they're not equal in practice, right?
Right. Yeah. And so, there's by now, relatively extensive literature in international relations that looks at questions of status and questions of inequality and how, these are formal equality in terms of the membership in the UN is formally equal. There are, of course, security councils and different forms of inequality still embedded. But, nominally equal organizations do not work equal. They simply, in many cases, reproduce the differences in terms of resources and wealth and military resources, right? So that's the first one, yes. And so then, just to finish that first rationale of why federations can be Eurocentric or at least problematic, then if we are not in a world that is full of relatively equal actors, then what we need to think is, so how do we make this inequality political? How do we allow for the inequality to become part of the conversation rather than kind of be an afterthought of a federation that assumes equality? So that is the first kind of challenge, right? If a federation doesn't work, what is it that works? And that's what I try to kind of respond to later. But the second reason why these federations may be Eurocentric, and again, I mean Eurocentric in the sense that they just try to broadcast, so to speak, a European model into the rest of the world without carefully considering, whether it will work or it's appropriate. The second way in which federations are Eurocentric is that they tend to focus on formal institutions among states rather than on emergent organizations or groupings or coalitions that are formed among non-state actors, but that nonetheless exceed the realm of the national. And so these are blocked out from view.
Yeah, good. I mean, maybe on that, just to follow up on this, because I, if I put my Habermas hat on, I'm not sure how this is going to work, but we'll see. You know, on the latter points, so that international organizations don't recognize sort of these non-governmental, you say like the international civil society kind of organizations. I assume part of the rationale of that is that it would be hard to distinguish what could be an organization that could be in the interest of cosmopolitan order and one that could be full of white supremacists or something like that. I mean, I think, granted, you know, your book is quite interesting in sort of making a case for some of these more informal transnational organizations. But I'm assuming that there are going to be lots of them that are, you know, not so savory, right? And so it's going to be, I take it hard on the part of international organizations to sort of distinguish legitimate from illegitimate forms of that, which is why I take it they try to incorporate them within the existing state structure, because existing states then have a means to sort of vet those organizations.
Yes. No, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, and there is a wide variety of transnational organizations. There are transnational neo-Nazi organizations. There are international organizations opposing what they call the, I can't remember now, gender agenda or the gender ideology. And there are transnational terrorist organizations and so on and so forth. So, yes, absolutely. Now, yes, I mean, these are hard questions. But the fact that we are putting organizations that are themselves not legitimate and that are themselves, in a way, reflecting a particular hierarchy of power does not solve the problem, right?
Mm.
So, I mean, it's a hard, challenging problem. And what we need to do is to develop tools to assess the legitimacy of these organizations in different ways, in a way that opens space to challenge the legitimacy of these, you know, sanctioned federations like the UN. And you can think about, you know, more economically oriented organizations such as the WTO or the IMF, etc. So, the fact that it's hard to determine the legitimacy of potential challengers or emerging spaces of politics, which I grant you, it's hard, is not a reason to just settle with the ones that we know and we know that are not legitimate, right? So, yeah, I mean, it's not an easy kind of problem, but I think raising the issue that some of the struggles are excluded from this fora, are excluded because they put in question existing power relations, is important. Because it is, I think, a step in the direction of democratizing or transnationalizing this sphere of international politics. And again, I mean, I don't have an easy answer to, you know, how we do it and how we differentiate. I just want to point out that the organizations that are sanctioned have the problems. And so perhaps we should pay attention to the challenges and try to make claims about what these challenges, when these challenges are adequate or progressive or opening rather than closing spaces of politics.
Yeah. And it's clearly a blind spot. I mean, and so your view is really helpful in that. The other, I wanted to mainly just sort of mention one of your other criticisms of some of this neo-Kantian literature, and then and move on to the third one, because I had a question about the third one as well. But the second one, you make the, I think, exactly right point, which is that, call it the unworldly Eurocentric character of contemporary neo-Kantian literature, which is that it purports to be cosmopolitan, but it doesn't invoke any voices or, you know, read any thinkers who are non-Western, and that strikes me as exactly right. The third point you make, which I wanted to ask you a little more about, but it's this, an ahistorical Eurocentrism. That, and let me see if I got this right, that part of the problem that with the contemporary neo-Kantian literature is that it abstracts from the historical injustices that are the basis for the existing cosmopolitan institutions. So, for instance, the UN or the European Union are formed out of building blocks that their own injustices that are constitutive of them are abstracted away from. And so you have you have an organization that's facially just, but actually depends on structures of injustices. Maybe you can say more about that.
Yeah. So first I should say that, the ahistorical part of this kind of Eurocentric dimension has to do not only with, you know, those who engage with this genealogy of cosmopolitanism, which is in the work of Habermas in particular, is quite clear, right? The League of Nations, which then fails, and the United Nations comes, and you have then the role of, you know, transnational movements of opposition to the Vietnam War, and with, you know, and then the EU, which, you know, he does state to be a model and expects other regional blocs to form something similar so that then you can work, you know, together. Kind of up there at that level, and he finds that to be conducive to cosmopolitanism. Now, so that is one kind of way in which their Eurocentrism can be ahistorical, that they don't consider the role of this organization, that they view these organizations too kind of uncritically. But I would also say that even those scholars who do, you know, I mean, I should say that, you know, Habermas also criticizes several features of these organizations along the way. Even those who address these organizations critically, they address these organizations as if they had existed in a vacuum, rather than as dominant players in a broader political realm that was contested by the non-aligned movement and the Pan-African, subsequent Pan-African congresses. Or other kind of actually existing organizations that have critiques and challenges of these organizations that are, I think, important resources for doing this this critical work. So even if you engage them, these organizations critically, I think that there is something ahistorical as positioning yourself as a theorist writing in the 20th or 21st century as the person that raises these criticisms, because historically these organizations were subjected to deep criticisms by colonial countries, by colonial peoples, I guess, and by minorities within the United States, in the case of Du Bois and the NAACP, which addressed these organizations in different at different moments. So it is these two modes of kind of limited view of these organizations. Mm-hmm. They're either just, you know, the growing path towards peace, or they are problematic, but all the criticisms are put in the voice of the theorist rather than reconstructing the criticisms as they took place in history.
Yeah, and one of the questions I had was what would we ask of the UN or the EU in light, let's say they agree and we want to recognize these past injustices. I wonder if it's, I mean, I've been thinking of this in the context of the American debate about reparations, which is quite an interesting debate, because it seems to me, I mean, maybe, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong on if this isn't a good analogy, but I take it the analogy is to something like reparations, right? So the idea is to recognize the past injustices that structurally made possible some of the existing institutions today. And if we do so, then we can sort of ground some kind of policies for redistribution. I take one of the objections to that, though, is something like the following, which is it might be better just prudentially to move forward, as it were, because recognizing past injustices is actually quite divisive. And in fact, sort of developing, you know, universal social policies actually quite beneficial to the minority groups that are themselves would be the beneficiaries of reparations. In other words, a policy of sort of abstracting from past injustice and moving forward is actually better for everybody.
Well, I mean, I'm not as familiar with literature on reparations as I wish. But okay, but so let me first ask. Let me first answer the first question, and then let me answer the expanded version with the reparations example. Okay.
Yeah.
So I mean, when people ask, well, I mean, what do we ask of the UN? Well, I mean, perhaps we think about the UN vis-a-vis other organizations such as the World Bank and the IMF, right? Because when you compare these organizations, there are several things that I think are relevant for the purposes of considering questions of justice and, in particular, economic justice. And I mention this because there are in the UN a series of sub-organizations that are, that do pose significant challenges to some of the member countries, the most powerful member countries. I mean, they are the UN, what's the word? It's not ambassador. Observer, these commissions that have observer status. And, you know, these observer status commissions regularly chastise the U.S. Regarding the treatment of immigrants. And the UN Organization for Development routinely issues reports and that provide accounts that are much more critical of neoliberal policies than some than reports that would come out of the World Bank or the IMF, right? And now, of course, the key difference between these two between the UN and other organizations is that the UN has no money, right? And so, you know, what if we gave the resources of the World Bank to the UN Development Organization, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, my answer to your short question would be, and I guess this connects to the second question, let's think about where resources are going today, resources that emerge from this international institutional architecture, and where resources could go if they were decided otherwise. I mean, you could even take this, you know, further and say, something else that the UN has always had is that it has had offices and ground offices with kind of local intellectuals around the world. In fact, much of the dependency theory and developmental thinking emerged from CEPAL, which is, you know, the kind of Spanish acronym for the UN Development Office. So then you could go one step further and say, well, I mean, why don't we think about organizations such as the Organization of African States or the Organization of American States that have quite a different kind of view than the centralized international organizations dominated by voting power by Western states? Why don't we distribute those resources, right? Mm-hmm. So that would be my first answer, right? So you can think about how resources are distributed and how can we rechannel those distribution structures. Now, in terms of the reparations and the objection that it is better to move forward rather than, you know, thinking about past injustice, particularly because universal social policies would benefit. I mean, and there, I think the my, and again, without being, you know, as familiar as I would want to be with the reparations literature, my answer would be that, well, I mean, how do we make these universal distributed policies happen if there is no recognition that this past is an unjust past? And so I think that, I mean, part of, the work of Catherine Liu, among others, the work is about showing the way in which existing political structures are indebted to the past in ways that operate as obstacles for the kind of universalist policies that we would want to implement. So it is, you need to go to the past. You need to open the difficult topics in order to even consider that something like a universalist welfare state rather than one that is targeted and punitive.
Yeah. I mean, just to put the point in a more pointed way, which is, if you think about Thomas Poga's view of sort of global distributive justice, so he doesn't look at, well, I guess he does look at past injustices, but part of his point is to look at the index of poverty as a sort of basis for the redistribution of resources. So I guess maybe to think about Poga as an, I mean, and he's a sort of great neo-Kantian example. I don't think you discussed them in the book, but I mean, maybe that'd be helpful for me to think about sort of what's missing in somebody like Poga's account. What I mean, I take it his would, on your view, be okay, but it needs to be supplemented in some way.
Yeah. I mean, I don't address Thomas Poggi in the book mostly because, I mean, while being a neo-Kantian, he does align himself with the more kind of analytical philosophy kind of group of global justice scholars. Mm-hmm. And I do a bit more work on them in a chapter that is part of Duncan Bell's Empire, Race, and Global Justice. Mm. Empire, Race, and Global Justice. So this is a 2019, I believe, book. And I think, I mean, not just, you know, to self-promote, but there are, you know, many, many chapters on that book that are actually addressing Poggi or other scholars in the tradition of analytical tradition of global justice that are really excellent. So, yeah, so first, as you say, he does address the question of past injustices, but I think that it's important to know that he addresses it in order to establish that there is a wrong and establish responsibility, right? And I think that he then takes the step of saying, well, I mean, there are kind of technical ways in which we can now redistribute, now that we know who is responsible and, you know, who is in need, we kind of, and he in fact, I mean, and he in fact says, well, I mean, there's, we actually don't have to change that many things, right? I mean, so I can't remember the specifics, but, you know, you could say, well, I mean, you require like a tax on foreign transactions or this, and then you, you know, redistribute this. And of course, you know, his project on health is very much on that kind of vein, right? We look for technical solutions to problems. And, I mean, and, you know, there's nothing, that I oppose in any of those projects, but, there is something that I find missing, and that is the, I mean, again, returning to my critique of Kant, which is the way in which these solutions are devised, right? So the recognition of the past injustice is not to engage with these particular experiences and to engage with the voices and organizations and the kinds of demands that they have made, but simply to establish responsibility and then to dictate particular terms for reform. And so, and I think that we're missing something if we do that. I mean, this, I mean, his ideas look like great ideas, but I think perhaps some of, you know, post-colonial peoples, I mean, perhaps not their governments and their elites, which in many times, of course, are supportive of very regressive policies, but the peoples, their organizations, etc., have ideas that are much more challenging of the world order than just taxing and redistributing. So that is kind of the way in which I would respond to an approach such as Poggi's.
Good. Yeah, so I think that sets us up nicely to talk about the constructive part of your book on W.E.B. Du Bois's view and the view of cosmopolitanism, which you call transnational cosmopolitanism, as a kind of alternative model to the Kantian view. And I think we could discuss that, develop that in three chapters in the second part of the book. And I thought that maybe we could discuss it in general in the way in which you take up the three different main points or main features of this transnational cosmopolitanism. But I thought first maybe we could talk about, maybe if you could sketch a way of sort of expressing it, you know, kind of in layman's terms. And I was hoping to think in terms of some examples. Your use of the Pan-African League was useful historically. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if you had examples, contemporary examples. One of the examples I thought of was the Me Too movement. And I didn't know if you thought that would be a good example of the kind of thing you're talking about, this way in which it's a, it's a sort of growing international, transnational, to use your term, sort of association based on sort of historically marginalized or oppressed peoples. So maybe you could, it's sort of in a nutshell, how the transnational view differs from the Kantian view.
So the transnational cosmopolitanism, which is, you know, the title of my book, I mean, at first could sound a little bit kind of repetitive or redundant, but basically what I'm trying to do with Du Bois is to justify why any cosmopolitanism should be transnational, in the sense that if we don't take our starting point to be local struggles and the way in which these local struggles oftentimes reach out for coalition and solidarity, and in so doing reconstruct that injustice is not something that happens domestically or something that happens in a centralized manner internationally, but something that really reaches into different spaces throughout the world in ways that are different but are connected. Now, I don't know if that is layman's term, so I'll try to kind of, you know, expand on that, because I know it's, you know, there's, you're going, you know, to the bottom and then up and to the bottom and then up. But let me return to the notion of equal concern to kind of justify why cosmopolitanism should be transnational. The notion of equal concern is usually taken as a starting point to theorize universal principles. And what I want to use this notion of equal concern for is rather the opposite, is to go from these universal principles to what the forms of injustice that are encountered and that we're opposing are, and what kinds of reforms are required against these injustices. And so in that sense, equal concern requires us to engage with local struggles, but not to stop there, but to understand these processes as basically resulting from global trends. You could think about colonialism, the slave trade, and other trends historically as being transnational. But you can, of course, I mean, it's even easier to think about them today, right? I mean, you can think about transnational corporations. I mean, these corporations have a headquarters, but they operate throughout the world. And now, their effects over populations might be different depending on where they are operating in a Western state with particular regulations about labor and taxation. Their effects will be different than if they're operating in a state with less capacity or that is more conditioned by particular, by its debtor status or by conditionalities. So they will be able to offer less resistance, or perhaps it will be a government that is partly in the hands of the elite and will be happy to invite this corporation. And so the force is a single transnational corporation, but the effects are going to be filtered by the particular kind of, you know, government structure. So the state doesn't disappear from a transnational approach. The state remains because it's central to understand how local forms of oppression emerge and why, while being indebted to something that is transnational, they are actually quite different. And so that about how injustice is local and different, yet connected to, sorry about that.
Oh, it's okay.
My phone is in silent, but my computer is not. So what about the first part, right? Why do we need to engage with the local to understand global forces, right? The second step why we need to engage locally is because in order to devise a notion of justice, or to start piecing together what a notion of justice, I mean, to be less ambitious, to start piecing together what a notion of justice may look like, I do think that we need to rely on particular understandings of injustice, but also particular forms of imagination that emerge as well at the local level. And these forms of imagination that emerge at the local level often converge with other local forms of local struggles for emancipation. And so let me go to the example that I offer in the book, that is a historical example, and then move to what would be a contemporary example. And so in the book, I focus on the Pan-African Congress and, primarily the Pan-African Congress, but in general, all the forms of interconnection and networking between anti-colonial activists and Black activists in the U.S. So what I found really kind of telling, and in particular, that I found that Du Bois was a privileged kind of source as a thinker to think about this, was the way in which the very subjectivity of the actors was transformed as these actors started to see themselves not as the victims of oppression of a national or domestic character, but as one instance of a broader system, in this case, an imperial system, a racial, racially hierarchical system of oppression that was composed with, of slavery as well as colonialism. Colonialism in turn was of indirect rule or direct rule. So these were many ways of dominating, but these were all based on notions of race and civilization as of hierarchical notions of race and civilization. And so Du Bois is such a well-known thinker among political theorists for his theorization of Black subjectivity, and in particular his notion of the double consciousness is so well known that to kind of disrupt that theorization by tracking how Du Bois stops thinking about Black Americans as subjects that need only address white Americans and kind of aim through persuasion and other forms and other means to aim for a racial, a US polity that is just. He instead turns to the world of colonialism, and he turns to empire, and he turns to those subjects that are oppressed in quite different ways, but by forces that he considers to be kind of uniform, or by forces that are, in a way, single forces that operate differently in different places. And so let me say something about this. So there are two, I think, main texts that allows us to do this with Du Bois. One is his novel, Dark Princess, and the second one is are his writings on segregation. So, I mean, the novel Dark Princess basically sets up a narrative in which a young Black student in the US who is unable to complete his studies and somehow through traveling to Europe gets in contact with a coalition of an Indian, a Japanese, an Egyptian, I believe that's all, activists. And so the novel just kind of traces this, and it's a novel and it's a romantic novel, this traces this kind of, you know, very competing, painful kind of counter pressures from the US as a space of emancipation versus the global as a space of emancipation. And I mean, of course, you know, this ends with the Black character going, you know, decidedly on the direction of transnational emancipation, but also by recognizing the way in which the US South, so slavery and slaves, are part of this global South. So that is one way where you trace how Du Bois really departs from his subjectivity as double consciousness, an analysis that is mostly, despite signaling, mostly limited to the US polity, into a transnational subjectivity that sees the future of emancipation in solidarity with other Black and brown subjects, right? But the second place where you see this transformation of a subject that sees injustice as a domestic issue and emancipation as equally domestic is his writings on segregation. And this is really interesting because the NAACP, one of the main agenda issues of the NAACP was desegregation. And in the 1930s, Du Bois starts writing quite openly in ways that favor segregation. But the rationale for this is really important because the rationale is, well, to the extent that we live in a racist polity, integration into this polity is detrimental because it's not going to allow Black subjects to realize the extent of the injustice and the extent to which US democracy is a damaged project and, importantly, an imperial project. And so he says, it is only those spaces like Black churches and Black universities and Black community spaces where we can speak freely. We can speak freely and we can think about our situation and, in particular, think about the echoes between our situation and the colonial condition, right? I mean, thinking about injustice in the US as part of a colonial condition, of course, was unthinkable in a mainstream public sphere in the 1920s and 30s. But these were the kinds of conversations that were being had in these segregated spaces. And so, ironically, moving from the level of the nation to the subgroup allows you to think transnational, right? Okay, so that is kind of the long kind of story of how situations of oppression that are conceived as national can be redefined as transnational when the commonalities between between several locations are discovered. And these discoveries, again, I argue, you can track them only by engaging with the political craft, right? And this is the case in Du Bois and, for instance, his activism and essay writing on segregation. Now, if you ask me for a contemporary kind of instantiation of this kind of organizing, I haven't thought so much about the Me Too movement in these terms. I mean, I think there is definitely something going on transnationally. But I've thought about a bit more in terms of labor organizing, and particularly farm labor organizing. So I think that, I mean, if you think about the way in which, I mean, from farm workers and small landowners in India contesting the way in which corporations are patenting particular genetic modifications and local knowledge, but also thinking about the way in which immigrant labor in the U.S. I think has been quite successful, I mean, in relative terms, of course, in organizing against labor exploitation, wage theft, and many other kind of, you know, everyday kind of features of agricultural labor as it takes place in the U.S. And so, and I think that, and let me give you just one third side, and then think about, for instance, landless movements in Brazil. Again, peasants or farm workers organizing for the way in which agribusiness and corporations are taking up land, that is, I mean, the best land, and are leaving this business without without land. And so, I mean, these are in principle quite different struggles. One, you could say, has predominantly to do with corporations and patenting, the practices of patenting. The other one has to do with a particular vulnerability that comes from undocumented status of the majority of workers in the U.S. in agriculture. And the third one that comes from lack of access to land. But I think that all of these actors, and I can speak more about the farm workers in the U.S., and in particular this coalition of workers in Florida that has expanded to quite a bit to other states in the U.S. But I think all of these groups would see themselves as, I mean, significantly as having significant affinities with others, with each other's struggles. That is because they are either dealing with agribusiness corporations that are transnational, firms like Monsanto, you could think about, or in the case of migrants in the U.S. Organizing against, in the case of this group that I have in mind, organizing against not growers, but the mass buyers, such as grocery corporations and fast food companies. In the case of the migrants, because they see their vulnerability as associated with, I mean, their being kind of uprooted from their rights and membership, and, you know, in a new space, in a new in a situation of vulnerability. So, again, I mean, I haven't, this example is not on the book, but this is part of new work that I'm doing on labor and farm labor organizing in particular. But I do think that even without going to specific cases of coalition making, I think all these three groups see their grievances as grievances that emerge from a global economy with an equal access to rights and with an equal access to state institutions.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it's helpful. I ask about example in part because I'm trying to wrap my head around for myself the sort of the overall shape of the view and how it's different than Kant. I mean, in parts, at some of the parts in your book, I sort of thought, heck, I don't think Kant would really have a problem with this. Listening to you talk, though, I mean, it sounds to me a little bit like Marx, and I wonder if you have a kind of Marxian interpretation, and I say that in the most positive of ways, because I love Marx, especially the early Marx. I mean, in part, what I have in mind is, it sounds like what you're talking about is that the transnational character of capitalism erodes the power of national sovereignties and gives rise to a transnational response in the form of labor organizations. And that sounds very much like Marx, and it sounds like you also want to apply it to colonies, right? So it's this sort of... former colonies and colonialism and the way in which European colonizers were of a transnational character and created a transnational response. You could say the same about slavery and so forth. And part of the Marxian view, I think, mirrors some of the things that you're talking about. I mean, when you go through these, we don't have time to talk about the different features of but the way in which, as you say, transnational cosmopolitanism sort of liberates individuals from a sort of a local setting, that they create a solidarity among oppressed peoples, and it creates a kind of counterpublic to respond to other sort of dominant views. So, it sounds a little bit like Marx. I mean, did you have that in mind, or is that the helpful comparison, or sort of gets us off track?
Right. Well, I mean, of course, I mean, Du Bois was a reader of Marx. His 1930s book, Reconstruction in America, it's a Marxist track. On the other hand, Marx was not particularly interested in race as an axis of difference and oppression. And so, there are definitely affinities between Marx's internationalism and his kind of distrust of sovereignty and nationalism in particular, and this also appears, of course, later during not in Marx, but in Marxists' critiques of nationalism leading to the First World War. There are these affinities, but I do think that that the way in which I develop the notions of subjectivity, solidarity, and then this counterpublic is, even vis-a-vis Marx, much more grounded and in a way bottom up, in the sense that I do not intend to have Marx had the answer. It was international solidarity, and this wasn't dependent on what he would find. And in fact, you know, his writings on the colonies are quite civilizational, and I mean, some would even say racist, but at least civilizational for sure. And so I think that this view, because it relies on Du Bois, which is, you know, a Marxist at least late in his life, but also a theorist of race, and to some extent a Hegelian, I think my priority is to go into these kind of more grounded processes of identity development, establishment of solidarity, and establishment of counterpublics that are more open to, you know, surprises and more open to contesting whatever a priori idea of global justice that we may want to put forward. So, I mean, I think you are right that there is an identification of capitalism as a transnational force, either in the form of imperial capitalism or in the current form of neoliberal capitalism. But I think at least I try to be more open to having the answers kind of speak to me from this exploration, rather than try to give these, you know, I guess, workers of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the manual to how to proceed.
Sure. Yeah, that's helpful. Final question here, because we're basically out of time. Yeah. I found the transnational part of the theory quite compelling and interesting. One of the questions I had is about the cosmopolitan character of your theory. Mm-hmm. So I get that, you know, the transnational thrust of your theory aims to sort of challenge the abstract universalism of the Kantian approach, and that seems mm-hmm. great, to attend more to the particularism of the injustices mm-hmm. in the globe, and to sort of build up from the bottom. But then I wonder how you get back to the universal, as it were. Like, what, you know, what is the universal or cosmopolitan character that, when does that come back into the theory? Because I mean, the transnational part is quite interesting, and you're envisioning a kind of robust global civil society. It's almost like Tocqueville, right? You want this sort of great associationalism, not mm-hmm. so much great focus on statism and institutionalism at the global mm-hmm. level, and that sounds great. But is there what's the universalism or the cosmopolitanism that comes back in?
I mean, so two things. There are, I guess, two sets of literature where I build upon here. I mean, and one is the literature in the humanities and in anthropology that has kind of, you know, appropriated the term cosmopolitanism in ways that do not require embracing a particular form of universalism. And this is where I get to the second kind of literature that that has been helpful, and that is approaches within political theory. I'm thinking of Judith Butler, but also within political theory, people like Laurie Balfour and James Ingram, that conceive of the universal as something that is continuously revisited. And so it does, you know, let go of the universalism as traditionally understood as an abstract ideal or as an abstract principle, but it does not give up on the ideal of universalism to the extent that it does aim to expand the realm of justice. It does aim to reduce forms of oppression in whichever form or place they occur. And this is, I mean, I build on these literatures, but I think this is also very much part of Du Bois's point, in the sense that he was, in his writing, his claim was, well, I mean, how are you going to, you know, figure out universalism or attain universalism, if not by looking to those that are outside of it? These are the people that you need to look for answers and for the shape of a society that will get closer to this kind of universal ideal of equality or of freedom, whatever you want to infuse the universalism with. So there is a universalism, but it's only this universalism that can be continuously opened and reopened. I mean, this is very necessary if we think about colonialism and post-colonialism, because it is quite clear that the injustices of colonialism in many ways have been, you know, replicated in different forms through authoritarian regimes. Regimes that are co-opted or willingly enter into coalitions of a corrupt or less corrupt character with corporations or Western states. So there is no ending to the forms that oppression can take place. And as a consequence, I would say that I think this is something that is present in Du Bois. There is no end to the way in which we need to revisit what our ideals of justice are in response.
Yeah. Well, that's a great place to end. And as I want to thank you for a great conversation. So thanks for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Yeah, thank you, Jeffrey, so much. It was a really enjoyable conversation. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.